Welcome to Life, Love, Insight, Fertility Experiences. I am here today with Sasha Adi, and I am so honored, actually. She is amazing. She is the executive director of PCOS Challenge, but not only is she the executive director, she created it, she founded it, she's done everything to get it off the ground. So Sasha, thank you so much for being here today. I was so thrilled to have met you at ASRM this year.
Lori, thank you so much for inviting me. It's my honor and pleasure to be here.
Honestly, when I we both did the soapboxes at ASRM. So it was the first time they had soapboxes, and it was like so cool, right? And it was so exciting. And when I heard what you did, I was kind of blown away. Get tears in my eyes thinking about it. So I was thinking that maybe we could just start with you telling your story a little bit, if that's okay.
So I was a 28-year-old working as a microbiologist, working in a lab. I was actually in a research lab at this point and missed a few periods and knew that was not normal, right? So went to an OBGYN to assess what was going on. She ran a few tests, did an ultrasound, and then diagnosed me with polycystic ovary syndrome or PCOS.
No, I'm sorry.
I know it seems like that's the thing to say. I'm sorry. But, you know, there are also positives, and we can get into that.
As I started to say, I'm sorry, I'm thinking to myself, well, you know what? Maybe I'm not sorry because look at what incredible stuff you've done because you got it. You know, I feel badly that you had to go through it, but I'm really kind of not sorry. So please forgive me.
Right. It wouldn't have been on my radar, right? So most people, when they do get the diagnosis, they're like, what does this mean? What is this? I've never heard of this before. And I was given a pamphlet that I read within 5 minutes or less. And that was it. That was it. She told me not to worry about not having my periods. There are plenty of women who would love not having their periods. Well, that's true. That's not the case for me. But Lori, this is not a unique story.
No.
Plenty of women hear this. That part is awful because it felt dismissive, right? It felt like my actual concerns weren't being heard. But then also, it was a missed opportunity on her part to educate me about, you know, even the connection between PCOS and endometrial cancer, right? And that is directly related to not having periods, right? Not having your monthly cycle. So it was a missed opportunity on her part.
I thought to myself, what insensitivity, right, to the situation. On so many levels. That's what struck me. That's why I got tears in my eyes when you were saying that, because it just struck me as insensitive.
That's how it felt.
Yeah.
And she did tell me, however, to come back to see her when I wanted to get pregnant. And she then referred me to an endocrinologist who I saw shortly after that. And he also told me to come back to see him in 6 months after I've lost weight without providing any tools. And Lori, I see your eyes like widening, but this is a common story for PCOS patients.
You go into the doctor's office and they say to you, come back when you lose weight. But it's very hard to lose weight when you have PCOS. It's not like, oh, okay, I'm going to go to the gym or I'm going to stop eating chocolate. That is not the way it works.
It's not the way it works, right? Your metabolism is different. You know, there are unfortunately so many knowledge gaps that are perpetuating some of these types of advice that are interactions between clinicians and patients, right? It's not just about calories in, calories out, or exercising more, eating less. Your metabolism is different. It's not your fault. And these are opportunities for my doctors to be more supportive. And especially initially in my journey after I got diagnosed, right?
28 years old. And, you know, I've had people actually come in and say that they've had so much weight gain and they don't know why. And it turns out they have PCOS.
Yeah.
They impact everyone in different ways.
They do. You have lean women and lean people who have PCOS. You have people who are in bigger bodies and have PCOS. It's a really heterogeneous condition. It impacts people differently. And hence, I had to do my own research. And this is what PCOS patients and a lot of similar conditions, but PCOS patients, they become detectives. They become really good at research and trying to figure it out, right? And that was the case for me. In fact, it became this defining moment in my life where I immediately knew I had to do something. I immediately knew I wanted to have an impact on the future of PCOS, but really importantly, the patients, the people like me who, after getting this diagnosis, felt kind of alone. And so that's where PCOS Challenge was born, within a few months of my diagnosis. The very night I went home, I knew that I was going to do something.
Were you going to start an organization or ever wanted to do anything like this?
No, I've never thought of starting an organization. I was never business oriented, but I knew I was here for, there was a higher purpose. And this immediately became clear that it was my calling. And so we started off, our mission is to raise awareness for PCOS, but then also to help people to navigate their journey, right? And prevent some of the life-threatening comorbid conditions like type 2 diabetes, endometrial cancer, etc. So we started doing podcasts. We did the first ever podcast on PCOS with over 100 episodes called the PCOS Challenge Radio Show.
That name, the PCOS Challenge Radio Show podcast.
It wasn't called podcast back then. This was back in 2009 or something. I don't think podcasts were that popular yet. We also shot a 13-week television show. We started doing a lot. When was it? 2010. So
you were able to do that in 2010. Wow.
We were completely self-taught. We got certificates for becoming television producers with our local TV station. So just a lot of things were self-taught. And to this day, initiated by, sustained by blood, sweat, and tears, right? Just drive and passion, because we know that just as, and especially as I learn more from people all around the globe, is that the stories are so similar. The experiences are so similar, regardless of how wealthy of a country you are, regardless of the actual resources you as an individual have, the stories are so similar.
So similar. It's amazing. When people are able to connect on it, it at least makes everybody recognize that, okay, this is normal for this condition. And that's really important. I know people don't always love to use the word normal, but you know, you want to feel as if you're not alone in the symptoms and all these other life-changing events that happen along with PCOS and what you need to look out for. So what have you been doing in terms of some of the comorbidities that arise?
Yeah, so I'll just take a step back, and just for the benefit of someone who may be watching who have no idea what PCOS is. PCOS is the most common hormone disorder in women. Mm-hmm. So it impacts across the globe 8-13%. So we usually say it's around 10, but it can impact up to 20% of women. So 1 in 5. It's a really common.
1 in 5. That is really, it's so many people. It means everybody knows somebody who has PCOS.
This is correct. And it's a genetic condition. So it runs in families. So sisters will have some form of the condition. Sisters and cousins may have some form of the condition. I'll go through how PCOS is diagnosed. So the diagnosis criteria is, they have a few, but the most commonly used, or the one that's the consensus according to the international guidelines, is if you have 2 or 3 of the following: irregular cycles. So if you miss a period, it's been months and you haven't had your period, or you're having a period for an extended period of time. So if you have less than 25 days between periods, more than 35 days between periods, that's considered an irregular cycle. Or if you have some signs of high androgens, these are like testosterone. This is what you may call the male hormone. So that would be facial hair. That's one of the first things that a lot of people experience, especially in their teenage years, facial hair or severe cystic acne. Those are two signs of high androgens. And then on ultrasound, you may see these enlarged ovaries or polycystic appearing ovaries, where they're like little immature follicles around the ovary. So that's what's called a polycystic appearing ovary.
Call it a string of pearls.
String of pearls. So if you see it on the ultrasound, it looks like a string of pearls. And that's what my doctor showed me, was the string of pearls appearing ovary. And one of the latest things added to the international guideline is, instead of doing an ultrasound, you can do an AMH test, which can also show. So if you have two or three, which is you have irregular periods or you have some signs of high androgens like facial hair, excessive body hair, or if you have an ultrasound or AMH showing that you may have polycystic appearing ovaries, that's how you get a PCOS diagnosis. Other common symptoms, as we spoke of earlier, would be weight gain, rapid weight gain, unexplained weight gain. That's a lot of women or a lot of people experience this. And then other skin changes, like in the folds of your neck or in other parts of your body, darkened patches. This is a sign of insulin resistance called acanthosis nigricans, which is very common in insulin-resistant people and also in PCOS. So there are lots of different symptoms. It's a constellation of different symptoms that can impact people differently.
Right. It's really a diagnosis by elimination or by identification of two. And that's a hard diagnosis to make.
It's either hard or easy. And I'll tell you what I mean, because the most classic signs of PCOS are irregular periods and maybe facial hair. That's facial and body hair. But a lot of us kind of shy away from even letting our clinicians or doctors know that, oh, I may have facial hair, because a lot of people are embarrassed by it, especially a teenage girl. And that's one of the saddest things that I've heard, or, you know, meeting people who are being bullied in school because they have facial hair or they have body hair and may have little excess weight, because kids are cruel. Adults are cruel.
And it doesn't mean that you're going to gain weight if you have PCOS, right? Not everybody does. So some people have the other symptoms. So somebody can be thin and have PCOS. It's just a matter of identifying the two out of four, whether or not you have it, and if you're symptomatic. So people could have PCOS and not be symptomatic also, or is it always symptom driven?
Or they don't connect the dots. They don't really realize that, okay, my hair is thinning. That's a sign of potential high male hormones, right? So androgen driven hair loss. So you don't think to ask your doctor about it. And then even if you go to a dermatologist, they may not ask you about your periods.
When you go through menopause, do the symptoms go away?
When you stop having your period, that part of it is over, right? However, you still have PCOS. You're still at higher risk for some of the comorbid conditions like type 2 diabetes. Your risk goes up the older you get, because one of the underlying conditions in the majority of PCOS patients is insulin resistance and inflammation. So those put you at high risk for cardiovascular disease and even endometrial cancer. That's something that can happen in PCOS, and the risk is elevated because of PCOS. So there isn't a lot of data on menopause and perimenopause, which is something that we're trying to change. Unfortunately, it does drive many of these risks.
It's really a lifelong condition. It's not related to your fertile years or your years while you're menstruating. And what do they do? Do they give you medication, or do they give you like a structured diet or exercise or lifestyle routine? What do they typically do?
Typically, like you heard in my story, most people get prescribed either oral contraceptives to kind of help with the hormone imbalance found in PCOS, or metformin. Metformin, which is PCOS is one of the most common off-label use for metformin use. And now we have other newer drugs, aka GLP-1 agonists, and that may help with PCOS and weight loss, but there still isn't a lot of data, but there's a lot of anecdotal evidence, right, that it will help with things like weight loss or helping to reduce some of the metabolic issues going on. But we don't know anything about the long-term impacts, the long-term effects of this, what happens when you've taken it for, I don't know, this many years. We don't have that much data in PCOS.
Right. It's amazing how you've done this. So right now, you got this diagnosis, you learned and understand the diagnosis, and then you started this organization. And so in starting the organization, how many people or how did you get to help you with it and participate in building this? Because it's a hard thing to do. And what's the trajectory? Like, what involvement would people have with this?
Okay, so we have multiple programs. It started with just me before he was my husband, but now my husband helps me a lot. It's mostly volunteer run. We have a patient advisory board. We do a lot of the planning and the programming. But one of the kind of landmark things that we've done is advocacy, in particular, legislative advocacy around PCOS. I needed to understand why a condition that's this prevalent impacts so many lives, so many families, was still going under the radar. It felt like nobody cared, right? So we investigated and found a lot of the researchers were saying they weren't getting funded for their research. They were leaving the field. So why was PCOS not being funded? We figured out how Congress works, right? How funding
was created. That's a big undertaking. That might be more of an undertaking than figuring out what PCOS is.
Right. Their PCOS wasn't mentioned at all in any of the legislative agenda. They didn't know this was a problem. Our government did not know this was a problem to solve, right? They didn't know that PCOS was the most common hormone disorder. So what we did was we knocked on every single door in Congress, House and Senate, and we found some advocates or allies on the Hill. First one was David Scott of Georgia. He wrote the first resolution for recognizing September as PCOS Awareness Month, the need for more research, which started our advocacy and policy agenda around PCOS. So we worked together, got PCOS September officially designated as PCOS Awareness Month, built a bipartisan PCOS caucus, and just did a lot of institutional advocacy and continue to do a lot of institutional advocacy.
So where did all the funds come from to do this?
So funds come from donations. Funds come from sponsorship. So this is the hardest part of running a nonprofit.
Yes. I'm listening to it. I keep thinking to myself, where does she get the funds to do it?
So the majority of what we've done have been us using human resources, sweat equity. That's the majority of where the energy and has the resources have come from. Very passionate volunteers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've worn holes in some of my shoes walking around in DC. Yeah.
Do you have events or do you have things that people can attend to help you if people want to get involved? Or people listen thinking, I've been struggling for years and I would like to be involved or I'd like to help.
Yes. So we have an annual event called the PCOS Awareness Symposium. This year, we're kind of tweaking the format a little. And there may be an announcement coming down the line of something that we're planning. But yes, so that's been going on since 2013, I believe, was our first event that was a community event where people came to learn from experts in the field. Experts came to learn from patients in the field. That's a really powerful thing, right? So we do that every year during September, PCOS Awareness Month. We've done other events, walks, 5Ks, PCOS Advocacy Day. These are huge events. You can also reach us at pcoschallenge.org. This is pcosawarenessmonth.org. And also our community is at pcoschallenge.com.
Community have chats, should you, online?
Yeah, so people chat with each other. Also happens on social media as well. So, of course, as the years go by, we kind of transition into whatever it is that the people and how we communicate with each other. But in-person events are always life-changing for people, where you're being in the same space with people who have this condition and you feel not so alone. And Lori, I'll tell you one interesting story, and this has happened multiple years, where people come to an event and they see their cousin or their sister, and they didn't even know that the other had PCOS.
Oh my goodness. Oh my Lord, that is unbelievable. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, I find that amazing. So it really, people, you know, everybody has so many boundaries and they put up a lot of walls. And sometimes we just want to communicate and let people know what's going on and balance about how to communicate versus how to set up a boundary. But if you're struggling and you're close with family, or not even like that close, but you have some form of relationship, sometimes sharing the information can help. And sometimes, like when we share information, we could tell people, I don't really want to talk about this, but I was wondering if you've experienced this yourself. Just something to open up the conversation, because I heard it's hereditary and I heard 1 in 5 have it. And there's 5 women sitting here and we're all related. So chances are somebody else has it. And that's the kind of conversation. Understanding how to open it up is so important. I was going to ask you, though, what the doctors, how do you find a doctor who's sensitive? I mean, I know you know several doctors, and hopefully I'll be doing an Instagram Live with one of them in September. But how do you find a doctor that feels like a good fit? Because sometimes it could be heart-wrenching to be in the doctor's office, know you have a condition, and then on top of knowing the condition, not have opportunity to share or understand it with the doctor.
Yeah, that's one of the most challenging things. And we've built kind of a patient-doctor communication guide, because sometimes you just don't know what to say. You don't know what to bring up. You know, you have a limited time to talk to your doctor. And some, a lot of the doctors are frustrated too, because they don't have a lot of tools in the toolkit for PCOS, right? Sometimes you immediately know that this is not the doctor for you, or this is not whoever it is for you. You immediately know. You can choose.
Yeah. Can we say, if you're going to a doctor and you feel like it's not a good fit, you can change doctors. You can try and talk to that doctor. Strongly encourage everybody, when you have a question, write it down.
Yes.
I know everybody likes to write everything on their phone, but paper and pen, and bring it into the office. And the reason why I say paper and pen is for a couple of reasons. First of all, when you sit and you write, you're using your mind and your body, and the mind-body connection is strong, and it alleviates some of the stress, at least for a moment. It's also freeing to put it down on paper. The other thing is, when you get to the office, you have your list right in front of you. Whereas if you put it on the phone, you're scrolling. You're not necessarily, you know, listening because you're typing. And here you could say to the doctor, I have some questions that I'd like answered. The doctor's not going to walk out of the room when you say that. He may say, I don't know, or we'll see, or it's just the way it is, but he will give you an answer. If you're not comfortable with those answers, you could tell them, or you could choose to find another doctor.
Great advice, Lori. That is, and that's not just for PCOS, that's just
no.
Everything, right?
Right. For everything. For fertility and beyond, right? Anything in life. And I think the one thing when you have something like PCOS is to learn how to empower yourself, to advocate for yourself.
Completely agree.
And you could do it very nicely. It doesn't have to be mean or frustrating or aggressive. You could do it nicely. And if the doctor doesn't respond well, that's not a good thing. And you can tell them, you know, you feel as if you're not being heard. Or if they say something to you like they said to you, actually, that's just the way it is, or come back when you want to get pregnant, you could actually say that right back to them. So you just diagnosed me with PCOS and you're telling me to come back when I'm pregnant? I have a million questions. Please, as you're talking about advocacy, and I am a big fan of advocacy, and enjoy doing it myself, advocate for yourself.
Self-advocacy is really important for living life with PCOS, right? Living life with infertility, living life with any condition.
Anything,
right? We know, we've seen the statistics of how things happen to women in a healthcare setting that shouldn't happen. We're told things that we shouldn't be told. It profoundly impacts a lot of people. For example, a doctor telling you to lose weight and come back to see them, just that interaction alone without any guidance can cause disordered eating. And there's a huge connection between PCOS and eating disorders. And that connection, some of the advice that's given to patients, you know, can directly cause some of this disordered eating and eating disordered behavior. So it's just so interesting and impactful how one interaction, one or two interaction, with how powerful that is to, and how much it can impact the rest of your life and how you live your life, right? So that's why your message there about self-advocacy is so important.
Yeah, and it takes strength to do. Let's not underestimate that. It does take strength. But, you know, you can start doing that just around your home with your family. You know, and you can do it when somebody says something that just seems like, what did you just say to me? We all have that in our house. You can't tell me anybody doesn't have that in their house once in a while. You know, yeah. And it's normal to have that in your home. It's not abnormal. It's normal. But when somebody's frustrated, they come home from work, or they had a bad phone call, or they had a bad day, or they fell and they skinned their knee, and they're coming in and they say something that's not really in the right tone or not really nice, start addressing it head on. Did you mean to talk to me like that? Give them a reality check.
Yeah.
You're advocating for yourself and you're helping them to see what they're going through. And it will be a relief on both parts. Bring that with you where you go.
I'll just also say that sometimes when you're in the moment, it can be daunting. And, you know, not everyone has that personality where they may stand up for themselves, or they may think in hindsight, I should have said this. Also give yourself grace if you don't have that type of interaction, or if it's just so shocking that you couldn't respond appropriately, right? But I think it's also, when people are experiencing pain, a lot of people don't advocate well for themselves too. Even if it's emotional pain, it doesn't have to be physical pain. Sometimes having someone to help you advocate, a friend, a family member, a spouse or partner, sometimes bringing someone along to appointments can also be helpful, because they will say, wait, hold up, what did you just say to her? Or am I getting this right? Can you explain it to me? I don't understand medical terms. Can you do it? You know, so sometimes having someone there to help you with advocating for yourself can be a useful tool as well.
The other thing you can do, which I always recommend, is call the office later. And there's no right or wrong. But if you leave and you didn't have the inner strength, or, you know, you were so taken back by what they said, you didn't address it, call them. Well, if you can get the doctor on the phone, talk to the doctor. Tell the nurse, send an email. Do that once you have your thoughts together with the organization that you work with. If people want to get involved, what should they do? They should go to the website. They should contact you, or
they can. There's a contact form on PCOSChallenge.org. That's PCOSChallenge.org. We welcome people who want to volunteer for events throughout the year or in September. People who have certain skills that can help us as a nonprofit organization, can help with fundraising, can help with event planning. All the skills are needed to help our nonprofit. Or if you're a patient or a parent of someone with PCOS, reach out. We can help you to learn or navigate the condition. Or if you're a researcher, clinician who want to participate or lead patient-centered research, that's right up our alley as well. So PCOSChallenge.org, or you can also email info@PCOSChallenge.org.
That's great. And they could go to a great event, or they could help create the great event, one or the other.
Absolutely.
Well, I am so blown away by everything you accomplished and everything you've done, truly.
You're very kind. For someone like you who have done so much for the infertility community, it does mean a lot. Thank you for all that you do to move the needle in the right direction.
I don't know that I do as much as you. I think you're remarkable, but thank you. Thank you for everything. And thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it. And it was so great meeting you at our soapbox talks.
Soapboxes to come, right?
Much soapboxes to come. Yes. And for people who don't know what the soapbox is, ASRM, for the first time this year, allowed people who have done a lot of work with advocacy to share their story and to let the advocacy work be known. And so, you know, it's finding the strength to be able to say what you want to say and create change like she did. I mean, amazing, right? But we don't need to all be like this and create a PCOS challenge. We could just do it in our own little world. If anybody wants to get a hold of me, please feel free to contact me at laurimetz.net. And I'll look forward to talking soon.